You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. Thank you for coming and braving the heat and the fire alarm and everything else to talk about a very important set of subjects concerning Africa and its challenges today, especially the swath of Africa that's most threatened today by famine, often interlaced with and exacerbated by conflict. So we're talking about a zone, as you know, that extends from northern Nigeria, really all the way over to Somalia, and then over to Yemen, if we continue beyond Africa itself. We'll talk today primarily about that zone within Africa, and beginning with Somalia, South Sudan, and Nigeria, but extending our scope of geography and the subject matter as you wish, because in the second half of the program, we'll be asking for your questions as well. My name is Michael O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. I'm joined today by a remarkable panel of experts on Africa, and I encourage you to read their bios, but just starting immediately to my right, Karen Atiyah, who works for the Washington Post in their global opinion section, but is also covers many things for the Post, including issues concerning Africa. She's a graduate of the SIPA school at Columbia and has been writing now for the Post on various topics and has been to Nigeria and other parts of the continent within the last couple of years, and that's probably where I'll begin the conversation is with her and Nigeria. Just to her right is Kristen Mackay from St. Lawrence University, a professor of comparative politics and Africa at St. Lawrence, has joined us previously at Brookings for discussions on the Great Lakes region of Africa and some of the challenges of democracy, civil rights, and other such matters in that part of the world. And we're thrilled to have her join us again today in our ongoing collaboration with St. Lawrence as part of our Africa Security Initiative. And just to her right is Comfort Ayro, who is here from Nairobi, where she runs the International Crisis Group activities for much of Africa, for I think all of Africa, from that perch. And has a PhD from the London School of Economics, has written a number of studies on various parts of the continent, including most recently a series of reports on the exact subject we're addressing today, those countries most afflicted and threatened by famine due to the kinds of ongoing challenges from the weather, but also, of course, from conflict that we've been witnessing throughout this part of Africa. I think all of you are aware that some 20 million people are considered to be at risk. We always hear big numbers of people threatened by famine, but this is a really big number, even by the standards of previous conflicts. And the world has gotten a little, perhaps a little better at dealing with famine, but maybe also, therefore, a little more accustomed to lowering our guard, that we assume it'll work out in the end, and that the horrible famines like we saw, for example, in Ethiopia in the 80s or Somalia in the early 90s won't necessarily be repeated on that scale. I'm just putting that forth as a provocation. I hope some of the panelists will address whether they, like me, worry that there may be a certain amount of complacency that's afflicted the international community on issues concerning everything from food relief and humanitarian provisions all the way up to how we handle these things in peacekeeping and conflict resolution terms. I'm about to wind up here and pose my first question to Karen, but just to complete the introduction on the subject matter, as you know, these parts of sort of Sahelian Africa or northern sub-Saharan Africa, if you will, these are the parts of the world that have the highest density of peacekeeping missions from the UN, and especially in and around Sudan, Central African Republic, and some of the other areas. We have an African Union mission in Somalia. We have a Nigerian military that the United States and others have been trying to work with, handling some of the challenges in northeastern Nigeria. But obviously, it's not quite enough. Whatever's going on is not quite enough at some level. Whether there are new and better policy options available to us is another part of the subject for discussion today. And so we'll turn ultimately as well, once we get through sort of understanding the conflicts and understanding the threats and the famine dangers, we will also discuss what some of our policy options would be, could be, including everything from increasing humanitarian relief, if that's a smart idea, to getting more engaged in conflict resolution and or peacekeeping and or peace enforcement. So let's try to keep the full range of possibilities on the table, and I hope that you'll hold us to that in your questions as well. So thank you, and without further ado, let me begin with Karen. And my question really is very simple to start with. It's just to help us understand your sense of where things are in northern Nigeria today, the ongoing conflict against Boko Haram and the Nigerian government, the ongoing instability in much of this zone. We'll begin with sort of a round of questions that tries to lay the groundwork and establish what we know about conditions today. And then maybe the second round of questions, we'll get into a little bit more of proactive ideas on how to address these problems more effectively. So thanks for being here, and over to you.
All right, great. Well, thanks, Michael, for having me, and thanks to the Brookings Institution for having me. Gosh, where to even start? So, you know, I've professionally been covering Boko Haram or Nigeria since I had the chance to work with Sahara Reporters in 2010. And so, of course, we saw how over those years from 2010 to 2013, 14, that Boko Haram was largely seen as just sort of a local issue. Even we know that the previous administration, Jonathan's administration, can rightfully be criticized for not taking the Boko Haram threat seriously. Again, this is until 2014 when we know, you know, Bring Back Our Girls, that campaign really thrust Boko Haram and that war into the scene. So I had a chance to go to northern Nigeria, northeastern Nigeria, specifically Adamawa State, which is part of sort of Borno, Yobe, Adamawa states, were the most affected by Boko Haram. And this was about a year after Boko Haram had amassed sort of so much power and weaponry that they were actually able to control swaths of territory, some swaths to the tune of almost the size of, you know, small eastern U.S. states. So, you know, while there was a lot of focus on, naturally, you know, the sort of devastation, the attacks on military holdings, the attacks on civilians, suicide bombings, when I was there in 2015, though Boko Haram had successfully been pushed back by a renewed effort by Buhari and the international forces with Cameroon and it was then that people were on the ground were sounding the alarms about the food crisis. It was then I had a chance to visit IDP camps. I had a chance to see where it was the local communities that were really having to absorb these IDPs that had come from Borno State. That, and again, I think Boko Haram, it wasn't as reported, but part of Boko Haram's tactics were not only to just slaughter entire villages that, you know, didn't resisted them, but they would also burn crops. They would also actually poison water supplies, kill cattle. So many of those people in the north who were affected were farmers, and so they had not been able to plant and had not been able to turn their crops. So the acute food shortage issue was already apparent even 2 or 3 years ago. And which is, you know, what I wrote about, that this is a crisis that, of course, at that time there were sensitivities about using the F word, the famine word. But, you know, there was problems of, and there still are, these are still apparent today, problems of access, of course. It is extremely difficult to get to, particularly Borno State. Even journalists, even Nigerian journalists, are not able to get access to some of those places. It's just, frankly, too dangerous. You know, the face of the problem of food insecurity was also, frankly, female. Women and children were the most affected. I saw, again, amazing stories of people opening their homes to IDPs who were traveling down to Adamawa. But again, these were cities, these were places that were already poor, already stressed. The American University of Nigeria did an amazing job in trying to use private funds and U.S. Support to help distribute maize and oil and corn. I went to feedings where I think in one cathedral, 4,000 people showed up. And it's so now, you know, so that was 2015. Now, when we have a situation where I think the recent numbers, it's 5 million people who are facing acute food shortages, and something like only 1.8% of the global funding call for what is needed has been met. I think you know, you saw the humanitarian agencies frustrated with, and, you know, also perhaps U.S. officials frustrated with this sense that the Nigerian government should be doing more, a bit of a reluctance perhaps from the Nigerian government to admit that this was a serious problem. Of course, reluctant to, you know, again, use the F word, which has certain, you know, political implications. But this is all, again, competing with attention for the Syrian refugee crisis, of course, Somalia, Yemen. So, you know, again, keeping in mind that Nigeria is one of the U.S.'s most sort of important partners on the continent, the second largest economy. I know they trade places back and forth between South Africa and Nigeria. But it really has the potential to set back Nigeria's progress as a whole. And it's a situation where it's you have a sense that that it's not being addressed properly at all. And with Nigeria also lurching towards, you know, economic woes as well, and with the political situation concerning Buhari's health. A sense that, you know, if something doesn't come soon, this could become a really intractable problem for the Northeast.
That's an outstanding summary of how we got here, and I'll come back to you in a little bit with some questions about what we might think about doing next, to the extent the international community may have some options, even if the Nigerian government itself is so constrained with its bandwidth right now. But first, Kristen, over to you to give us a little bit of the lay of the land on Somalia, if you could, please.
Absolutely. Yes, thanks again for inviting me and for this great turnout. So I haven't been on the ground like Karen has, but what I have been looking at most recently is looking at the famine 6 years ago in Somalia, around 2011, 2012, and the response there. What are some of the lessons learned? You know, what's similar still today from 6 years ago? What has changed on the ground in Somalia? And how we might think about, as Mike said, moving forward now. And so I think there are, even though the situation in Somalia, you know, there are a lot of similarities from 6 years ago, there are some differences. And of course, some of those differences are the new government, the new president being in place. We've moved on from the transitional government that had been in place during the 2011-2012 famine. But clearly, the new government is a very young government, and so there's questions, of course, of their capacity and you know, international partners who will work with this government and how that will play out. Another big difference this time in Somalia is that al-Shabaab has lost a significant amount of territorial control from what they controlled back in 2011-2012. They've been driven out of most urban areas and also away from port cities, or, you know, port areas. So there's less issue of humanitarian organizations gaining access. However, al-Shabaab does still control sort of central southern Somalia, which is where, unfortunately, a lot of the drought conditions that are leading to the famine is most acute. So that still is certainly a big part of the issue in Somalia. You know, this question of how to gain access to the al-Shabaab areas, you know, should humanitarian organizations, you know, try to negotiate with them, try to work with them, which is, I think, something that we can come back and talk about a little bit later. And of course, too, linked to the al-Shabaab presence is this lingering question that exists today still of competing agendas between anti-terrorism operations against al-Shabaab versus the humanitarian famine relief. And I think a lot of the issues that came up in 2011, 2012 was this tension about, you know, especially with anti-terrorism laws, humanitarian organizations were basically restricted from trying to aid, you know, suffering populations in those areas because of the fear that resources would be diverted, by al-Shabaab, or even al-Shabaab was taxing humanitarian organizations to be able to work in the area. You know, there was registration fees of, you know, $10,000 and, security fees that al-Shabaab would charge. And so really it was a case that humanitarian organizations would be thereby funding al-Shabaab, and that would be, of course, violating anti-terror laws about not funding terrorist organizations. And so that created a real dilemma for humanitarian organizations that again, still exists today. And the question, too, I think will need to be addressed is both the new Somali government and also the current U.S. administration, have both really signaled that a surge or sort of a push, an anti-terror push against al-Shabaab is something that needs to be considered. And I think that could raise potential issues for the famine relief. Raising hostilities there, having violence break out, would certainly make it much, much harder for humanitarian organizations to reach even the populations that they're able to reach around Mogadishu and some of the areas out of the al-Shabaab territory. And so I think I know a lot of European partners have kind of said, why don't we hold back on any offensive until after the famine has, I don't want to say solved, been solved, but until after we get a hold of, able to bring relief and get to a point where, the food crisis is a bit more stabilized. So those are all things to consider. I mean, I think that the famine here, sort of as Karen said, similar to in Nigeria, clearly food security has been an ongoing issue in Somalia, but it's really sort of at a crisis stage right now because of two seasons of poor rain. And so a situation that was already dire has been made, sort of even more so. Livestock deaths another thing that has been different this time around is that it seems that al-Shabaab is allowing populations to move out of their areas of control. I think in the 2011 famine, al-Shabaab really tried to keep people in where they were under al-Shabaab control, and then restricting aid coming in, and that created a PR disaster for al-Shabaab, with many people dying. So I think, interestingly, the fact that al-Shabaab is letting people move, go to IDP camps in Mogadishu, move into Ethiopia or Kenya, is an interesting change for sure. And so I think the international community needs to think about that. Is it worth trying to go into the areas or trying to encourage people to leave the areas if al-Shabaab is making that possible? The other, the last difference I want to bring up is that al-Shabaab is trying to take an active role in providing famine relief themselves. How big that role is, we have the sense that they probably don't have the resources to fully address, the 6 million people who will need food relief. But they have been trying to provide some, water trucks, bring in food aid and whatnot, and putting videos out there, really trying to show that they're taking care of the problem. And so that's, I think, a new development, whereas in 6 years ago, they're very much sort of keeping aid out, but not delivering aid themselves. So again, a few differences, but I think a lot of the lessons learned about late responses and various aid modalities that worked or didn't work can still be applied today.
Excellent. Thank you. Comfort, over to you. And thank you for your excellent work with the crisis group on this set of issues. Mm-hmm. I realize you've done reports on all the countries we're talking about today, so anything else you want to add? But certainly to bring Sudan and South Sudan into the conversation as well, please.
Thank you very much, and to our audience of participants. Let me go back to your introductory statement and provide sort of a bigger context. Good. And then drill down to South Sudan. I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the time in which the Secretary General announced either the declaration or the imminence of famine and food insecurity was a time in which the administration here announced its own budget as well. So it's a real perfect storm that not only we may see a reduction on this side in terms of aid assistance, but also at the same time when Europe is going through its own crisis and Europe is pulling back and shifting its own priorities and the question marks as to whether we're going to get the kind of assistance that we've traditionally expected from either European partners of the US. So this is taking place in the context of real economic crisis from the traditional allies that tend to have this sort of international humanitarian agenda. So it raises questions as if it's not going to come from there. Where is the money, relief, assistance going to come from? So I think that's one thing to bear in mind. I think also another thing to bear in mind in all these crises, very much spectacularly seen from the Nigerian sense, is that the conflicts are now bleeding into one another. So you've got, you know, a homegrown crisis from Nigeria now, you know, partly because of Nigeria's own complacency as well, but also the Lake Chad was always a vulnerable place. There was a lot of underdevelopment. There was also poverty, and it shouldn't be lost to any of us that a number of these crises are taking place where the state is absent, so in peripheries. So partly of those combination, you saw the insurgency spill over into Chad, into Cameroon, and into Niger as well. And also, when you look at it from the South Sudan dimension, you're seeing the massive refugee flows into neighboring countries that themselves are domestically fragile as well. So concerns about how you shield them from a crisis. Also, I think that it should not be lost upon us that this is also taking place at a time when international organizations themselves, that are traditionally the vehicles of providing the relief, are also in a permanent state of crisis themselves. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the European Union, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's the regional bodies, the Africa Union or ECOWAS, they're all in a permanent state of crisis mode as well. So I think it becomes a real perfect storm in terms of who's going to support these countries. It also, finally, another word before drilling down to South Sudan, it shouldn't be lost upon us that, with the exception maybe of Nigeria, you know, you saw a recurrence of conflict, particularly in South Sudan, where you had a UN footprint. And in the last 5 years, what we've seen across the continent, in Central African Republic, in Democratic Republic of Congo, in South Sudan, it's where the UN has a footprint, we've seen a reoccurrence in conflict. So what does that say about the big agenda for peace building as well? And what does that mean for the future of peacekeeping, which you're going to raise? And in South Sudan, it comes home clearly to roost. Because here is a country, the latest new country on the continent that was midwifed by the international community, led by the US and by the Europeans, and also by the region. And, you know, the bulwark, the country that was the enemy, Sudan, is now instrumental in helping to avert a real famine. Because South Sudan's future is also very much contingent on Sudan keeping its borders open to allow for importation of food as well. So the enemy now has become very vital to prevent South Sudan's crisis as well. When you look at the conflict, I think from an early warning organization, we save ourselves from trying to say we told you so. But the interim period between the conflict, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement year of 2005, up until the time when we were supposed to deliver this new country in 2011, there were lots of failed, there were lots of failures by the international community and the region to fulfill the basic requirements of that peace agreement. And the fundamental one was to encourage, nurture, and develop this liberation movement into a more of a viable democratic institution that can help guide governance in that country. And what happened is the international community did what it traditionally does, is that it does enough to stabilize, but it never goes 100% of the way, which is to help drive that vehicle for change and transformation. And so lo and behold, you get to 2011, and you get that classic struggle between different forces within the liberation grouping. A lot of contestation over corruption, access to wealth, access to key institutions, that all have money, a real tension between various ethnic divides, and a real struggle over how you share arrangements. And so you get that classic problem of succession of power and how you transfer power over. So we get in 2013, a month before the civil war broke out, in December 2013, the language was, we are cautiously optimistic that South Sudan will continue on the right track, that is United Nations, and we have international donor community holding an investment forum because the economics in South Sudan suggest that this will help lift the country out. And then the country goes into a civil war. Now, the region, to be fair to the region, although it never declared it as a central goal, the region has been successful, and I say it relatively, in averting a proxy war in the region and averting a regional war. What it hasn't been able to secure is an internal peace for the country. It accepted a notion, a very narrative notion of peace, which is Juba is secure. And also Uganda averted a coup by intervening very, very quickly to bolster Salva Kiir, the president's position. But we have a situation today where the other key leader in the crisis, Riek Machar, has been exiled, and we have to deal with the government's own notion of peace, which is the use of force as an instrument to get the various opposition groups to negotiate a pathway into the transitional government, offer of amnesty, or the default position is to pressure through force. The government strategy, or the government appears to be or thinks it's winning a war. I mean, it's a peace through attrition. Now, the key question is how does the international community deal with that? And it's not a surprise that where the declaration of famine has been declared is in these two areas where there's a lot of pressure and a lot of fighting in these two counties. Again, not surprising, because one of the consequences of the conflict is that the opposition groupings have fractured. The conflict has become increasingly localized, and the solution has to, at one level, be localized. We have a real dilemma in South Sudan today. It is a country that was delivered by the international community, but it's also a country that has managed to avert all pressure by the international community in terms of finding a pathway to peace. So I think the other very stark, brutal lesson that we've had to learn over the last 5 years is that increasingly there are limits to what the international community can do to deliver peace in these countries. The institutions have been exposed. They've become increasingly fragile. They don't have the bandwidth to cope. There are too many other crises, either on the continent or elsewhere. Syria is the big one. And we're leaving the solutions to the region. The region is part of the solution, but it's also part of the problem. So in terms of where we find the solutions, I think we need to rethink the formula, and we need to also rethink how we do peacekeeping, how we do peace building, and the kind of ingredients that we put in place to help build, in this instance, a new country. In Nigeria, I think a number of people are wary that you have this incredibly wealthy country that has been complacent in its own response. And in Somalia, you really do have a conflict that has been in existence since 1991, and not enough ideas in terms of how to turn this around. But the lens of countering terrorism has been the lens in which international community has tried to solve that problem, not looking at the bigger issues to stabilize Somalia.
Thank you. That's a lot on the table already. Let me ask a couple of questions to just maybe bring a couple of concepts together and then ask for policy ideas as well. I guess one thing that occurs to me in reading about this issue over the years and then hearing the three of you is it seems that at least in two of the three countries, food is actually being used as a weapon by one group or another, or maybe multiple groups. Maybe less so in Somalia these days compared to the past, because as you said, Kristen, al-Shabaab maybe is even trying to, for whatever reasons, be slightly more cooperative. So I guess to go down the row, if I could, first of all, could you explain for the country that you talked about specifically, and Comfort, feel free to bat cleanup and talk about all of them if you wish, but but we'll begin with Karen and Nigeria, and then Kristen and Somalia. To what extent is food being used as a weapon? And then in the case of Somalia, why do you think al-Shabaab is not using food as a weapon as much as it might have once? What's behind that change in thinking, just as we sort of set the landscape for then discussing policy options?
Mm-hmm. I think as far as, if it's this seen as a strategy of Boko Haram, it was, again, the sort of deliberate poisoning of crops and cattle, as people were fleeing. As a tactic, I think again, where you had, at least from what I saw, a bit of not so much as a weapon, but perhaps local leaders being accused of using food or using supplies that were being received or that were received from the international community as political leverage, yeah. Right? So I believe not too long ago there was one of the local sort of mayors or leaders was found guilty of hoarding supply. So that was a situation that was going on. As far as, you know, again, it was, I think, Nigeria, I think now and back then when I had a chance to be there on the ground, suffered from, again, its international reputation as being fantastically corrupt, and yet having that Nigeria should have enough money and enough resources to deal with this problem, that it was just a lack of political will, really. And again, I think Nigeria was a case, and still is a case, where I saw, where at least for me, you know, as a young reporter, you're kind of questioning this sort of international aid scheme that you have. Various organizations that we have this idea that if people are displaced, we should build camps, and that the camps can only have their own ways of reporting and their own ways of admitting those who have been victimized by Boko Haram. But the vast majority of people who've been affected and who are going through these hunger issues are outside of that system and are being taken in by families and by communities. So a real sort of, I was seeing aid groups struggling with how to deal with that. And I think, again, as far as, you know, using, not so much as a weapon, but the problem with the government, even again back then in 2015, trying to pressure people who are in these IDP camps to go back when, again, no crops, no food. I interviewed farmers who just said, there's nowhere for us to go back to. And yet in this effort politically to show the world that they were winning the war on Boko Haram, the government, and still is, trying to pressure people to go back home. So I think that is one serious issue, you know. And again, as far as I think this really could be, we discussed the challenges, but you know, could this be an opportunity for us to again rethink how we structure our aid response? Could we rethink about, are there ways that the private sectors or universities could step in and fill these sort of gaps? Again, we think immediately of World Food Program, we think immediately UNICEF, and they're doing amazing work. But at least from what I saw, it hasn't been enough. So could this be a way that we rethink how we deal with food crises, but also, you know, migrant crisis? And again, Nigeria is extremely difficult because even one community that has been kind of counted and recorded in one community, they're on the move constantly. So I met a lot of people who would come down from Borno, go to Adamawa. Some would leave to try to make their way to Abuja, then come back. And so it was very incredibly difficult to really kind of get a hold on even just accurate numbers, accurate sort of tracking of disease spreading as well. I think these camps also, we talk a lot about food, but also water and hygiene is a serious issue when it comes to these conflicts and when it comes to the international community's response. So, I know this is a case in Somalia, I believe, and but cholera, measles. So it was very difficult to be able to contain the spread of these diseases. So, I mean, I think in Nigeria's case, again, it not so much that, if anything, Boko Haram fighters are also suffering from, you know, lack of food, and then we saw evidence of their fighters also starving, right? And they would raid towns anytime there was, and this is a problem again when it comes to humanitarian assistance coming to help people who have been victimized by Boko Haram. I had an opportunity, I didn't know this at the time, but I had an opportunity to be a part of an aid convoy delivering medicine, food, and it was fascinating. Yeah, it was fascinating to be able to see that, but also an incredibly dangerous experience, because you knew that Boko Haram, they were hungry, they were lacking medicine, they had been pushed back into the Sambisa forest. And so any delivery of aid, we knew that it had a high potential for that town to be attacked and those supplies to be raided. And sure enough, a few days after we left, that town was attacked. And so that's a perennial problem when it comes to providing any sort of aid and support to these areas that are afflicted. How do you do that without potentially strengthening the terroristic forces that you're trying to fight, but then also how do you deliver aid without making that population a target, right?
Yep.
So
yep.
That was a difficult situation.
That's good. I'm going to come back to you one more time in a minute on some of the options we ought to be thinking about. But Kristen, if you could say a word about Somalia and also maybe explain a little further how this anti-terrorism concern has inhibited the actions of international agencies, or at least American agencies. I don't have a really good feel for just what the effects of that have actually been in people's decision making.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's an astute observation that that food is not being used as much as a weapon now. And granted, I have to say that the famine and famine relief is still quite new this time around. So we'll see, you know, as we go forward in the months, if the situation changes. But yeah, I think al-Shabaab has sort of shifted its use of food as a weapon, mostly because that strategy last time really didn't serve them at all. It was quite short-sighted. They were trying to keep really humanitarian organizations out of the region, but yet were not then able at that point to fill the gap and provide the food relief or even, like Karen said, medicine and other services. And it really created a backlash against al-Shabaab among the populations that were living in the area that they controlled. So I think this time around, al-Shabaab has, you know, taken a longer-term view and know that if they, again, try to keep the humanitarian organizations out that and don't replace the food aid, that it's not going to turn out well again for them. But I still think they're still politicizing food aid. So they're not using it as a weapon, but still making it very political. Even 6 years ago, they banned World Food Program and some other more Western organizations. But yet they were able to work a bit with some of the more Muslim and Arab humanitarian organizations. The Red Crescent was able to deliver aid and some of the other organizations. And even bilateral partners. Turkey has actually gotten involved this time both last time, but even more this time in Somalia. Saudi Arabia has I believe, promised aid. And so it would be an interesting picture to see this time, you know, who al-Shabaab is willing to negotiate with versus not. You know, will they still ban World Food Program and UN agencies? Will the Arab and Muslim organizations have a better chance of providing some aid? And I think, too, another thing that was a result of the food as a weapon last time is that a lot of the humanitarian organizations shifted aid modalities. Instead of just providing in-kind food aid, they started moving to more market-based solutions, so unconditional cash transfers and voucher programs to try to get around this issue of food as a weapon. And even though some organizations were skeptical of these types of interventions and aid modalities last time, they actually seemed to be quite effective. They were able to be scaled up more quickly, getting vouchers to people, getting cash transfers to people was a lot quicker than bringing food from abroad. They offer greater choice to the end recipient. A lot of people, maybe they were able to take out a loan and buy food previously, so now they had a debt. And so that cash, they're able to pay that debt back. They didn't need the food, they needed the money to pay that previous debt. So that was another advantage of these type of cash transfer for purchases. And also, there is a sense from reports of the previous famine relief that these cash transfers really were able to sort of reach a greater number of people than food aid would have been. And also, you got a better sort of return on your money. A lot more of the actual dollar amount went to the programming than would have it if the funds had been used to purchase food and transport it and whatnot. So I think that's another interesting a result of the weaponization of food before has been the shifting of aid modality that might actually be a positive development.
Jump in.
Please.
So when you mentioned Turkey and its mm-hmm. involvement with Somalia, mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody remembers, at least on Twitter a few months ago, when all of a sudden there seemed to be this activism around Turkish Airlines Help Somalia. I don't know if anybody remembers that. But basically, it was actually a big sort of campaign. Celebrities got a hold of it. Basically, found out that Turkish Airlines was one of the few airlines that could fly, to Mogadishu. Okay. So the thought was, well, if they can, then they should be able to fly truckloads of aid. And so there's a huge, social media kind of campaign to try to pressure Turkish Airlines to pay for a plane of food. And, in a sense, what that shows, if we're talking about kind of the changes in the sort of global geopolitical landscape when it comes to aid, it's thinking about now who are the new partners, the new people on the scene, Turkey, Gulf states, even, gosh, China, you know, that could fill the gap where Western countries are unable or sometimes unwilling, right, to, to send aid. So, I mean, I feel like that's also kind of this thought when, you know, you're having perhaps the U.S. indicating that it's going to step back from its traditional kind of humanitarian moral responsibilities.
Great. Excellent. Good point. And over to you, Comfort, please, now to...
I'd want to just
jump in on that or whatever else.
So I just want to say one of the things that we observed, that it's while much of what you're reading of Al-Shabaab, I think in terms of differences and similarities since 2011, one thing that we have observed, however, is that, you know, especially February and March of this year, we saw large numbers of drought-stricken families and victims try to flee the certain areas in South Central. Al-Shabaab was still continuing to block and prevent that exodus out. And it wasn't just blocking Western relief, but it extended that effort to prevent aid to by Muslim NGOs as well. So it hasn't... So that paranoia that we saw in response to the U.S. airstrikes and also the regional intervention in 2011 is still very much there today. So I just wanted to put that as a qualifier. But also I want to add that we're quite right to focus on Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram. But one of the things that we have seen is the humanitarian fallout of the counterinsurgency by Nigeria in the region, that while the military approach, the military first approach has been an important one, and we've seen some successes, it's come at a high cost. And one of the things that, in terms of policy options, I think if there's one thing that needs to be corrected today, is that military first approach must be accompanied by a more comprehensive approach that thinks through how it's going to provide reconstruction and political dialogue, I mean, and how to engage Al-Shabaab. Some of that's happening anyway in terms of how you release the girls as well. So I think, and also I think that's why we've also been very clear that there has to be a more civilianized dimension to the multinational joint task force. That much of the operation, the thinking, even around camps, it's been delivered by the military, who don't have the knowledge to know how to run camps as well. And I think we should also, you know, caution the state governor of Borno State. While Nigeria generally has an allergy to this kind of international aid assistance, and a lot of it is stems from the Biafra war and how sides were taken in that conflict. What is also driving Nigeria's awkwardness is the concern that the foreign becomes a permanent body, even if it's an altruistic foreigner in the notion of a humanitarian agency as well. I mean, so, and I also just wanted to sort of nuance the Nigerian narrative to say that this is... It's almost a huge leap of faith for a government that has been in denial for a very long time to accept that there is a crisis on the northeast border. And it wasn't until the Chibok girls happened that there was a reality check on the country anyway, and particularly south of the federal capital. So getting the rest of the country to understand the crisis. But in response to what you said about the private sector, completely right. What we observed, we went to the Nigerian Economic Summit. It's kind of Nigeria's own mini Davos among the private sector, and there was a very clear message by the private sector to the private sector to say that the governor is on his own in trying to work this out in the northeast. And you have to support him, and that we can't rely on the government, a government that is overstretched itself and is slowly moving its own governance plan out, and that the partnership has to be private-public as well. So where we are there, I think, is still a struggle, but the governor has been at the front face and trying to encourage that public-private partnership. But it's been a huge leap of faith for Nigerians to even accept that. So you can understand the psychological dilemma for Nigerians to accept that in their own territory, there's in food insecurity, malnutrition, on the same scale potentially as the Biafra war. Yeah. You know, so, and that generation is still alive as well. Yeah. The other thing I want to say about Somalia is that it's not just Al-Shabaab actually that I think poses a danger in terms of famine relief and drought as well. We have the clan militias as well, mm-hmm. who are also, so in terms of policy options, I think with how you get the clan militias to also unblock the checkpoints and to provide relief to their own areas. So Puntland and Somaliland also have a drought as well. The one common link between all the three countries is the bureaucratic impediments that we've seen, either at the provincial level or at the state level. So I think that's a big ask in terms of how you can unblock access to a number of areas. It's important that you get rid of this red tape at the Somali level, but you also provide access to a number of the areas in Nigeria as well.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. We've got a lot on the table, including a number of elements of potential new policy approaches that have been discussed, either are being attempted on the ground or have been proposed by our panelists today. So let's invite you all now to keep pushing the conversation forward on whatever parts of this broad subject are of interest, whether it's sort of understanding better conditions on the ground or thinking about what we should do or what we should encourage local parties to do. I'll take two at a time. Please wait for a microphone. Start with the woman in the yellow sweater, and then we'll take one more before coming back to the panel.
Thank you. Thank you very much for a very sadly interesting presentation. Naomi Hussein, I'm at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex. My question is, we've been talking a lot about conflict as a cause of famine, but what I really wanted to ask and to push a little bit on is the extent to which the panel think that food insecurity, chronic food insecurity in a lot of these areas linked, of course, to climate change is actually a cause of this conflict, and whether these are kind of cyclical, circular problems we're seeing here.
Great question. Thank you. And let's take one more. Let's take the gentleman here in the red shirt. Actually, we'll take two more. We'll deal with row three here together. So both of you, and then we'll take another round afterwards.
I forget if it was Comfort who said the comment about crises following in the wake of the UN, and I'm wondering that could be interpreted in one of two ways, that they're doing things that are generating crisis, but also are they simply being installed in places that are already unstable and they're just postponing the inevitable kinds of adjustments that are needed. All of this has sort of echoes also of the refugee camps in DRC, and there a critical lesson was the physical placement of it and the ability to maintain security of people moving in and out, because as soon as you had people masquerading as refugees coming and going, the militants became in the camp, and they took over the distribution of medicine and food and other things. So I'm not convinced the cash transfer is any kind of remedy to that. It really goes to a recommendation of how you're managing and controlling the valuables that are there, and also controlling the physical space around the camps, so that if there's not the ability to be moving in and out perpetually and infiltrating the camps. So they're putting them well away from the battle zone. This seems to be a critical feature.
And before you pass the microphone, could you identify yourself?
Ross Herbert with USAID.
Thank you.
Hi, Alexis Arieff with the Congressional Research Service. I also wanted to follow up on Comfort's point about the reemergence of conflict or the continuation of conflict in new forms in places where there are already UN peacekeeping operations. And you noted that should maybe provoke some discussion or consideration of what that means for international peacekeeping approaches and the international peace building agenda. I wonder if you could just elaborate a bit more on what you think that tells us, or how the discussion needs to shift, and if you could touch also on Mali when you address that question, that would be very interesting.
Okay, great. So why don't we start with Karen and just work down, and don't feel free to take all the questions, but whichever one most moves you or feel like you have a good response to.
Sure. So I think the question about, again, camps and security, a while or not too long after I was there, yeah, there was a few suicide bombings in IDP camps, which led to naturally kind of, I guess, panic on both sides, of course, of Boko Haram. But again, as Comfort mentioned, a fear of an overreaction on the part of perhaps the Nigerian forces, Nigerian security forces. This issue of so cash vouchers or transfers, I mean, you saw, you know, some aid groups doing the traditional kind of food drops and those sort of things, and then others that were using, I think the American University of Nigeria was using innovations with vouchers, with using mobile phones as well for like electronic vouchers that they could take to certain markets and then be able to exchange for whatever provisions that that they needed. But you know, of course, I mean, I think I'm not sure if my comments are necessarily an answer or solution, but you know, the whole sort of orientation towards dealing with kind of those who are fleeing conflict and famine with camps, it's on one end, again, it's this bedrock of how the international community organizations have dealt with the fallout of war for decades and generations, and yet states that are hosting them don't want this. We saw that, I mean, we see that in Nigeria, again, when they're trying to sort of force people back to their homes. We saw the Kenya's Dadaab's attempt to close down Dadaab, citing the same sort of concerns, right, that Al-Shabaab is recruiting in the camps. We can't control the activity there. And again, a sort of denial about how intractable the conflicts are that they're facing. Again, Boko Haram is still active, is still rampant, it's still an ongoing conflict, and yet trying to figure out ways to make it so that the reminders of how intractable the conflicts are, which very often are camps, and again, in Nigeria's case, same thing, that they don't want this permanent international presence in that sense, aid regime in their country, makes it so that it's this perpetuating cycle, I guess, of denial and also of fear and uncertainty for those who are being forced to flee and for refugees. So I think that's, you know, from Nigeria to Kenya to Uganda now that is facing the strain from South Sudanese refugees and this question of camps. I think that's a perennial issue.
Well, could I come back? This is very interesting. I just want to make sure I'm taking in all the different points because there are complex forces at work here, clearly. I think I hear you saying, Karen, that and maybe building on the question, that there may be situations where governments overstate threats from the camps. On the other hand, the camps may not be the best way to provide aid just on its own terms.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Right? I mean, you just see, and in the case of Nigeria specifically, there were scandals about, you know, trafficking in the camps, rape, also, again, disease outbreaks. Most of the people don't want to be in camps at all, right? But yet, that is, again, the foundational sort of way of how the international community responds. But the camps, from both sides, right, can be easy targets, both from the governments, you know, at any point, right? And then also, yes, can be targets from the terrorist groups that we're fighting. So it's tricky. I don't really know what the answer is, but I think it's a part of, basically a part of the landscape with these conflicts.
Very quick aside, I was in Jordan in November, and it's striking in Jordan, far away from the part of the world we're talking about, but still dealing with a very serious problem with vulnerable populations, that of the more than 1 million Syrian refugees on Jordanian soil, very few are in camps.
Right.
Most of them are essentially interspersed within villages, living with cousins or what have you, and that may or may not be a replicable model in all these cases, but it's worth pondering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Please, Kristen.
Sure, I'll just respond very briefly to the question about the cash transfers and the vouchers, and absolutely, I take your point, and I think you're exactly correct, that this is certainly not a perfect aid modality. I mean, there are a lot of the problems with food aid being diverted, being captured, especially, like you said, with groups operating within the camps and setting up, you know, almost governments, you know, within the camp and being able to tax the population to get their resources. Certainly, that's still in place. But I do think beyond the advantages that I did mention earlier about the scaling up more quickly and being more useful to populations, the other thing that I think that cash transfers or vouchers do help with is that it is supporting local farmers, local shop owners, local suppliers, and so really trying to keep at least some semblance of a local economy going and in place. That will help later on with resilience and rebuilding, which is something that I think this word resilience I see a lot more talking about famine relief. It's not just solving the problem today, but it's thinking how can we actually set networks and economies in place that can take us beyond the famine. And so, I think you still need both and probably other aid modalities as well. One's not going to be the answer. But yeah, absolutely. I think that's a point well taken.
Upward.
We tried in the three countries that we focused on, Nigeria, South Sudan, and Somalia, to also draw attention to the drought-affected nature of these crises, that they're not necessarily linked to conflict themselves. So the Horn of Africa itself is facing real drought. In Kenya, for example, we looked at the same with the Lake Chad. Basin and South Sudan, certainly on the border with Sudan as well. To Alex's and the gentleman's more bigger other question. Where to start? it's interesting that at the top of the Trump agenda, as a result of a very slimlined budget for aid, is the future of peacekeeping, and I think that depending on where you stand, it does offer some opportunity to get the UN family to think about how to. Think more effectively about peacekeeping on the ground. But a lot of the ideas and the ingredients of how to do this was written in the review panel of 2015 or 16, and even 10 years before that by Brahimi as well. So regardless of what the president here has put on the table, there are elements in place in terms of how to do peacekeeping or peace operations more effectively to think and to be relevant to the situation on the ground. In Mali, was the right solution for Mali at the time a massive peacekeeping operation, or what was required a special political mission that focused on the politics of the crisis rather than a short focus on the crisis itself, but focus more on the bigger national questions and how to deal with the tensions between Bamako and the North as well. In the DRC, our sense was that we got caught up in the numbers games and we did not think about how to make MINUSCO fit for the political challenges that will arise come December 2017 so that it doesn't become the target of political violence that will inevitably occur. In South Sudan, we virtually created a mission that became a Christmas tree, a panacea to try and rebuild, but it never dealt with how to deal with this transformation. So it was everything else but the more difficult political work of how you get how you transform a liberation movement into a political movement as well. So, and I think the concern for us, at least the crisis group, is that the UN, whether in the form of a peacekeeping or even a special mission, never quite works out its entry strategy and then becomes a permanent fixture and then becomes an easy target for an entrenched leader and or an, a useful strategy for a leader that is seeking an extra instrument to protect and keep it in place as well. And that is the dilemma we have in MONUSCO. So there are bits of the UN that Kibuli doesn't want, and our sense is that the conversation at the Security Council emboldened him further because it was speaking to those bits of the of MONUSCO that it didn't want. The bit of the UN mission that will hurt or could potentially hurt Kabila is the more sharp end of the peacekeeping eye in the form of the intervention brigade that is there to sort of help deal with problems on Eastern Congo as well. And then you have a situation in Bamako where we're 1 year ahead of the election. Neither side has confidence in the peace process. MONUSMA has become the most perilous and the most dangerous peacekeeping mission in the world. It's at the sharp end of the counterterrorism strategy. We've seen a high, unprecedented level of casualties, and it hasn't. And we're one month away from change to renewing the mandate, and the conversations cannot be about more troop deployment, because even when we did increase the troop numbers last year, they were not game changers on the ground. In fact, what we've seen is a mission that is hemmed in its barracks and is not able to be increasingly mobile to go after the various militia groups. So while we've seen a real security traffic jam in Mali in the form of the French operation, the regional force, the UN peacekeeping and the Malians, we haven't altered the dynamics on the ground. So is this the right formula? The weak link in all of this is a real consideration of what the politics of these countries ought to look like, and it's a more difficult task for much of these entities to get engaged. There is a conversation now taking place in Mali about how to strengthen the civilian component of MONUSMA to go more local, to sort of enable local conversations in terms of driving the peace process. But it seems as though a lot of effort has been put into Mali, and yet the dynamics on the ground haven't changed significantly. So this is what I mean about rethinking how we do business when you ultimately don't change the dynamics, but sometimes sort of solidify those dynamics on the ground.
Could
as well.
We stay on this for a minute, if you don't mind? Because I want to advance a provocation and see how you react, and others may, Kristen and Karen may want to as well. Very good points, and very nuanced and persuasive. But let me just take a further step back and look at the missions we're talking about in general. It strikes me, and again, I'm going to paint with an extremely broad brush here. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that in Mali, we still have a situation that, as troubled as it is much better than it was a half decade ago.
Sure.
And therefore, I'm inclined to try to sort of work from within on reform of the mission, and you probably are too. Mm. In Congo, to expect the UN to solve the Kabila crisis would be unrealistic. That's not really what a peacekeeping mission can do. Now, of course, we don't want to prop up Kabila. So if somehow Kabila were only able to stay in power indefinitely because of the UN peacekeeping presence, then you'd have to rethink it. But it strikes me as, to first approximation, a UN mission that you may sustain because, you know, to the extent it's addressing problems in the East, they're at least not as bad as they had been 10 or 15 years ago, and you've got to handle the Kabila crisis in some other way. However, now let me turn, and by the way, in Somalia, as you know, even though things are very troubled, it's still not as bad as it had been 5, 10, 20 years ago. So yes, we should try to keep reforming the Africa Union mission and helping it do better, but it's still better to have it there than not. However, and I realize I'm just advancing a provocation. However, on South Sudan,
right.
I am starting to worry that we are complicit in a man-made famine. That that in a way we have to extend the lessons we learned in Srebrenica and in Rwanda, where the UN presence allowed, or because of the tight rules of engagement and the restrictions, essentially allowed these genocides to happen before our eyes. And we decided we're not going to do that again. We're not going to be complicit on that again. But on South Sudan, are we maybe now doing it in a different way? That we're essentially, with all these people on the ground, things are actually getting worse before our eyes, and we are
we're not causing it, but we are standing by and watching genocide by a different form happen before our eyes, mm-hmm. and we ought to rethink whether we should be there at all, unless we're going to go in with Chapter 7. Right. So that's my provocation.
So that's a lot of provocation thrown at me. So you have reaffirmed one of the big concerns that we have, you know, and it goes back to, once a situation is good enough, then we tend to walk away. Mm-hmm. So you set the bar too low. I mean, and who decides when it's good enough? And what is the baseline of your decision to go in the first place and come out? So let me put that down as a first one. We would agree with you that MONUSCO is being left alone to sort this out. Let me also add the International Criminal Court was left alone to sort of deliver peace in Sudan, and look where we are today. So let me just put that down as another mix. But which is why we've also made it very clear that the burden of providing a political solution to this must be taken back to the Security Council, and it must step up to the plate. It defined a mandate, a mission. And it's left the hard task of trying to get a leader to step down of power without working out what the incentives are to help guarantee that.
Right.
Look what happened in Ivory Coast. I mean, look what happened in Ivory Coast. I mean, there's a right lesson. We are potentially on the verge of an Ivory Coast trajectory here in terms of what's happening in the DRC. Now the ball, the burden to do something currently lies with the region also, because the region has come up with its own sort of template to help Kabila see his way out of power. So much of that depends on South Africa, which is preoccupied and to a certain extent has punched below its weight. And an increasingly frustrated and concerned Angola that is watching its border very, very, very closely as well. So the future does rest with the region to help work this out. But it's also that the Security Council owns this process as well. And it's put the burden to deliver this on a mission that really does not have the capacity to deal with election-related violence. But so far, what it has done to stem certain crisis has been important as well. So I don't want to paint a very negative picture on MONUSCO as well. But let me go back to what I was saying about an incentive structure as well. In all of these processes, we don't think about formulas in which to induce good behavior as well. So as difficult a pill it is to stomach, we potentially, you know, because the government in South Sudan perceives itself as having the upper hand, how can we induce certain good behavior to try and turn that perception into paving the pathway to peace? So the government has put down its own idea of a formula of peace, ceasefire, you know, negotiations with armed groups, and also a national dialogue. All of this will solidify the government, something that the international doesn't like. But is there a way to think through, you know, tools for inducing good behavior? And what does that look like as well? You know, the soft landing of Charles Taylor has been shot out the window, so nobody believes that idea. You know, but there are other tools in which you can, you know, say to Salva Kiir, if you show commitment to your idea of this peace solution, we know that you don't have the capacity to maybe drag everybody else along to support that, but we can offer you certain processes to deliver that piece. But so maybe the logic has to be, you know, can we encourage you? Can we nudge you in the right direction? Can we lay down incentives, structures to help you think through your way out of a crisis as well? Because these leaders are in survival mode.
Yeah.
Right. Kristen and then Karen on the same general subject. Do you have any thoughts? Take a pass. Okay, Karen, over to you.
just from the sort of media perspective, I mean, just when the UN stood by and did nothing and watched as people were being, you know, slaughtered, I mean, it was, you know, even just in the eyes of sort of the international media, it did lead to these questions of, then what is the UN there for? Right, mm-hmm. And back to this question of strengthening the mandate. And I believe the commander of that was replaced, yes. I believe, right? But still, this fundamental question of sort of peacekeeping and missions in these conflicts. I think that was one shining example. Mm-hmm. And then Mali, I mean, I'm sure everyone knows, but it's the most dangerous mm-hmm. UN peacekeeping mm-hmm. mission in the world mm-hmm. as far as casualties, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you raised just a really interesting question about these pieces.
Excellent. Well, let's go to another round of questions from all of you. So we'll go up here in row two, both the questions, and then I'll take another round later.
Thank you. I'm Musu Clemens. I'm with MSI. I think, Comfort, you're onto something when you say that the international community and the Security Council has to think about a formula for inducing good behavior. I'd like to point to teeny tiny Gambia, where ECOWAS and the AU, and Gambia is not an important country when you talk about strategic importance. However, the way the AU and ECOWAS managed that situation to move Jame out of there, as you comfort said, he was in survival mode. Had he not been taken out, he would have been killed, his whole family probably. But I mean, that was, I think, a lesson learned for the international community to see how the AU and ECOWAS dealt with that. The other point I'd like to make is, you know, when we talk about, does food insecurity provoke conflict and peacekeeping and the nexus of all of those? You know, I read an interesting article a couple of months ago where it talks about how we must think and draw a distinction between individual radicalization and extremism and how communities respond to a breakdown of law and order and conflict. So I think the international community, we are certainly short-sighted. You know, we look at the counterterrorism response as the be-all and end-all to dealing with Boko Haram, al-Shabaab, and any extremist group that exists. If there is not the accompanying humanitarian response, we're just tilting at windmills. I mean, I just left Chad 2 weeks ago, and I was fortunate to talk to some members of the Multinational Joint Task Force. And one of the things they said to me was, we desperately need ways to engage the population. Yeah, we are military guys, but if we are not able to win hearts and minds and really understand what people need, we are ineffective.
Thank you. Sir.
Hi, my name is Ben Albert. I'm with Plan International. This is a global children's rights organization. And so what I do within Plan is engage the private sector in development. So I think unsurprisingly, my question kind of gets at what all of you have mentioned in one way or another, whether it be unconventional aid modalities or specific examples with Turkish Air. I think, so what are your policy, you know, advice or recommendations in terms of governments in your, you know, the countries that we were talking about right now, in terms of engaging the private sector, both locally and with multinational corporations? So I guess if we could dig into that a little bit further.
Good. And I'll take a couple more because let's go to the two gentlemen, one in the red tie, one in the blue shirt. So I have a big round here and see how we do with divvying up the answers.
Thank you very much. My name is Steve Paterno. I'm with the South Sudanese Embassy here in D.C. In terms of solution to South Sudan, I tend to agree with Comfort that the conflict nowadays is being localized. Can that be supported? Can that be the way now to achieve conflict? Because all this time, they talk in Addis, they talk in Tanzania, who are focused on the leaders who are now irrelevant. They're out of the fight, and the fight now is localized. Can there be a solution?
Thank you. And then one more.
Hi, my name is Gustavo Nabel. I'm with the Committee for Free and Democratic Equatorial Guinea. My question is, where is the role of the African Union in all this? You never hear about the African Union. We know that, you know, for example, the Chinese spent $20 million building a new facility out there, and you have to wonder whether or not they've been co-opted by the Chinese and what role China is playing in all this chaos, the hidden hand. But I'm wondering, with regard to peacekeeping, famine, stability issues, what can be done to restructure the African Union other than it being looked upon as being a dictator's club?
Okay, so why don't we, Karen, you want to start, and then we'll just work our way down the row, and hopefully we'll get sort of one or two questions per person if it works out that way.
Sure. So on the issue of the military, I mean, again, particularly in the case of Nigeria, and Comfort brought this up, when you look at death tolls. Often you see it phrased as the death toll in the war against Boko Haram. That also includes, I think, casualties inflicted by the military on civilian populations. You know, even my experience with traveling even with the military to deliver aid, and you made that point that, again, so much of this response is being delivered by the military that also doesn't have the trust of the people who they not only need for delivering aid, but also for intelligence, right? Very often it's part of the issue of surveillance and intelligence capabilities is that these communities don't have the trust of the military to be able to provide them with you know, advance notice of when attacks are going to happen, just to put that out there. But again, the response to Boko Haram has been very much a militarized one. Of course, our government has authorized the sale of, you know, attack helicopters, warplanes, which reinforces, some would say, you know, would reinforce Buhari's approach of a heavily militarized tact to Boko Haram. But I, you know, of course, I think all of us agree with you. And it's interesting to hear that that in Chad, you know, one of the partners in the fight against Boko Haram, they're realizing, I think governments will realize, that a military solution will not be the only solution. It needs to come with development. It needs to come with rebuilding infrastructure. I mean, still, you go to some of these areas at least a year ago, and you find there's no presence of the government. People are rebuilding roads themselves that have been bombed out by Boko Haram. And this is that the thought of, you know, again, are there other partners? Could we imagine a situation where the Chinese come in and say, you know, we'll offer to help you rebuild, you know, a post-conflict support? Could we imagine a world order where that is the norm if the West and if the U.S. decide to step back? Who would fill that vacuum? And maybe you do see some European countries, in, again, response to their own migration crisis, seeing the effects of Africa's crises at their doorstep, all of a sudden saying, well, I guess we should invest in development in some of these countries so that there are employment opportunities, so that these people aren't coming and coming to our borders and causing, you know, our political problems. This question of the AU, I mean,
it's a start.
I mean, at least the Gambia situation and ECOWAS, that was stunning. And that was, in a sense, an example of, you know, these regional blocks. I think that was Ghana, Nigeria, these regional heads really taking leadership of this situation and you know, urging a positive outcome. I guess you could say, you know, he did loot his way out, right? So, you know, perhaps sometimes offering golden parachutes does have perverse incentives, but it did avert a regional crisis. So for the African Union, yeah, this perception that the African Union, for all its rhetoric about respecting, in general, rule of law, constitutions, protecting civilians, that it has failed in so many instances to be able to either conflict prevention or, you know, being able to rouse enough political support. In the case of DRC, I think it's been a serious failure already. And I'm sure my panelists have more to say about the African about the African Union, but those are some of my thoughts.
Good. Thank you. Kristen.
Yeah. So to pick up on the African Union talk briefly, I mean, from my looking at the African Union, I'm, you know, not certainly an expert in this, but I think part of the trouble with situations like, you know, AMISOM in Somalia and some of the others is that, you know, to get countries to commit troops to the African Union missions, they really don't want those troops actively engaged in, you know, sort of a conflict situation. And so in Somalia, it was, you know, very much just protecting Mogadishu and, you know, just having that, you know, not really engaging, you know, Al-Shabaab sort of in the field as much. And so, it's a tough line to walk, right? You want to force that's effective, but then you also want to make sure that countries are willing to commit troops. And it's hard balance. But I agree that I think that the regional groupings, ECOWAS, SADC, East African Community, more seems to be going on there, actually, than the AU. And I I think the other problem with the AU that we saw, I think, in Cote d'Ivoire, what someone mentioned in other places, is that you definitely have sort of regional or just different countries just disagreeing on the right strategies, right? Whereas in, I think, the regional communities, they're a little bit more maybe seeing eye to eye on some of the issues. This is a little bit of a tangent, bringing up the Gambia situation. We talked about this a little bit before the panel about these golden parachutes and how to convince, like you said, with positive incentives, leaders to step down. And I think one of the hard things about that is thinking not just about the leaders themselves, but these leaders all have their networks, their patronage structures, all their founding associates. And so it's not just about creating a soft landing for them. Mm-hmm. It's how you actually, sort of get the whole, sort of network disengaged from the presidency and whatnot. And so I think that's difficult. And it's interesting that in Gambia, they were able to extract Jammeh, but what has happened then to his network? I don't know. Let's see if there's anything.
Could I?
Yeah, go for it.
On the topic, peacekeeping just came to mind, where it can be, again, problematic is where if you have countries that are contributing peacekeeping forces, particularly I'm thinking in Burundi in particular, where when the situation in Burundi with Nkurunziza was going south, and the first questions, well, can we sanction Burundi?
Right.
And then, no, they contribute a large number of forces to helping to fight, these regional crises and Al-Shabaab. Same with, Uganda. The rhetoric here is in D.C. is that, well, Uganda's been a reliable partner, has contributed forces, which means that any solutions to whether or not the political situations in these countries go south, there's always this, yes, but they help fight our battles.
I think in the case of Burundi, we've walked a little bit further along the line because we're here. We avoided them using that security veto as a reason to.
I just remember in the initial part that was the we can't really touch them. The U.S. We're wary of pulling funding and support for their for their troops because So I think that's another kind of, again, not that we have. I know we're trying to talk about solutions, but other wrenches to some of these issues that we should keep in mind.
But it's an important solution. But let's test it out in Burundi. This is this effort to use a security veto as an excuse to carry on. We've seen it also that the troop contributing countries also threatening to walk away from Somalia as well. In terms of how to engage the private sector, let me answer it in this way. I mean, one of the things that all these countries around the Lake Chad Basin need to start thinking about is the day after, and the private sector is going to be part of that. Today we have on the table, at least from the Nigerian side of the shop, what the government calls the Buhari Plan, and it is their Marshall Plan to deal with reconstruction of the Northeast. One of the reasons why the international aid agencies and the rest of the international instruments have struggled to help Nigeria is because there's a sense in which there's a lot of corruption and there's no transparency into that aid, how that aid is going to be delivered. But this is also a Nigeria that is facing multiple threats, and one of the biggest ones is the economy. Although there are indications that the oil prices are slightly improving, but it's still a country that's under, serious economic threat. And if we look at it in the lens of this is a productive country that should be able to cope with itself, we may miss an important opportunity to help deal with this problem. So how do bodies like the World Bank, and they're beginning to think about it, how do they help the government deliver the Buhari Plan, which is a very expensive, monumental, lots of volumes to read and to go through it. But how do you deliver that plan at a national level? But how do you ensure you link it up to other efforts in the region? So it's not just a nationalistic plan, but it's also you have a more joint up regional approach that deals with the Lake Chad Basin, which with that, regardless of Boko Haram's existence, faces unemployment, underdevelopment, poverty. And there would have been another, if it wasn't Boko Haram, it would have been somebody else as well. So how do you prevent that from happening? So I think that's something that is worth thinking about. In terms of is a localized solution a response to South Sudan? I mean, I think they're multi-layered solutions for South Sudan, but one of the most important things that we do need to concentrate on now, as I said, because the conflict itself has become sort of multi-layered and fracturing and more localized, how to think through the local dialogues and how to provide incentives to help Salva Kiir and then the armed opposition to initiate some kind of local dialogue that is not just the use of force, but it involves real dialogue and conversations about how you start to build peace from below, I think is going to be part of the struggle for both the country, the region, and the international community as well. And this requires a level of intimacy that the region hasn't been able to, at the heads of states, hasn't been able to deliver for South Sudan. But can I sort of provide a different, slightly more different narrative on the African Union as well?
Yeah, I'll have to make that the final comment, yeah. but please
one,
do.
One thing that I would say is that this year has been a good year for ECOWAS. After what we thought was a period of regression, Guinea-Bissau, Mali, Cote d'Ivoire, you know, this has been a good year. So it was good to see ECOWAS strike back in the same way, and it's been good to see how, of all the regions on Africa, this is the one region that has been very protective of democracy and democratization and has shut down the third term debate. So I think it's been a good year. But that doesn't mean it hasn't also been a good year for the Africa Union. I mean, I think what we saw at the summit level, and it started last July, but it also started in the context of the European Union also saying to the Africa Union that we cannot continue to underwrite the future of AMISOM in this way. And it was also a wake-up call from, because of what was happening in Europe, that we were not going to get this kind of assistance. So the Africa Union has had to put on the table quite seriously the issue of self-sufficiency and how it begins to finance itself. It started also in response to Mali and also in response to the Central African Republic. So we have a reform agenda on the table that was delivered by President Kagame. And we also have a peace fund on the table that was put in on the table by Donald Karabuka, the former head of the Africa Development Plan. The question is, how can you help the African Union deliver this? How can you get the member states to commit to their union that they've always struggled to commit to as well? So, and also, you have at the helm, potentially, we have to wait to see how Chairman Faki is going to perform. One of the interesting things that we saw when he went to South Sudan and also to Somalia is that not only did he take the Commissioner for Peace and Security, but he also took the Commissioner, the Chairperson for Political Affairs. Never done before. So does he understand that the solution is not just a military one, but is a one of governance? So we have to see where he's going. But it's true that the African Union faces a test in time. Again, I go back to the perfect storm for the African Union, the partnerships that it's traditionally have either with the international, with the United States or with the European Union are being redefined. And so it has to look back home and work out what is the most efficient way to deal with peace. Just like Guterres came into the UN saying prevention, you know, Faki has also recognized that it's prevention, it's conflict prevention, and it's that political role. So we have to watch to see where it's going. It's been a tough year for the union, but for the first time it's put, you know, on the table, based on past decisions, a clear roadmap. Can it deliver it, and can its member states help it deliver it? I think we have to wait and see where that conversation goes.
Nice to finish on a somewhat positive note. Thank you all for being here. Please join me in thanking the panel.